Thank you everyone for coming to our Kol Yom Rishon. Just before Rabbi Schmidman introduces Rabbi Ries, I just want to thank the sponsors for this program. The Kohelet Foundation, Kohelet Yeshiva High School, the Torah Academy, Laura Marian Synagogue, YU's Center for the Jewish Future, and the Jewish Federation. There are also two additional sponsors, Rabbi Weinbach, who you heard earlier, who is sponsoring this memory of the Shloshim of his father. Also, Rabbi Rafi Eis and Atar Eis, in gratitude for the shimush that Rabbi Eis had with Rabbi Ries at the Beis Din. Just quickly, for the next Kol Yom Rishon will be on March 13th with Rabbi Ephraim Kanerfogel. Rabbi Schmidman.
Thank you. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Gwen Horowitz and Reisaif and all the other people who took care of the logistics for this particular event and in general for Kol Yom Rishon. Also, obviously, want to introduce our very, very distinguished speaker. It's a tremendous honor to have Rabbi Yonah Ries here with us today. The official CD has very impressive statistics. Rabbi Ries is, of course, a distinguished alumnus of Yeshiva University. She was Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He graduated from Yale Law School, he worked at a very prominent law firm, Cleary Gottlieb, so he understands, quote-unquote, the real world, the outside world, the secular world. But somehow, even having in that capacity, he never left the walls of the Beis HaMedrash and ultimately took upon one of the most important, I think, positions in the Jewish community, certainly in North America, as the head of the Beis Din of America, and currently has a very distinguished and challenging post as the Max and Marion Grill Dean of the Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan Yeshiva, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. I don't think there's a yeshiva in the world that has more rabbeim than in its Beis Medrash than YU. And Rabbi Ries is in charge of all of them and in charge of the yeshiva and its many talmidim and its vast students. But having, as it were, worked in both circles, he is particularly qualified to address the sensitive issues that he will be discussing today. And in addition to his presentation, he has graciously agreed to also answer some questions at the end of the session. I have to say that in addition to being an intellectual titan, he is also a supreme mensch and an individual who can be turned to for sage advice and who has always shown a willingness to help others in need. It's a pleasure to call upon Rabbi Yonah Ries. There are sheets that I think were handed out. If you haven't received them, they'll hopefully move around with.
Well, good morning, and thank you very much, Rabbi Schmidman, for that very warm introduction, and also Rabbi Seif as well for his very warm words. And it's a pleasure to see all of you here, many familiar faces in the crowd whom I know from a number of different walks in life. And it's particularly a privilege to be able to speak about this very important topic. It's a topic that is often on people's minds because I think that there is a lot of confusion regarding exactly what the role of the Beis Din is and what the various obligations are towards going to a Beis Din and what its jurisdiction encompasses. It's interesting because in many of the parashios that we read about in the Torah, often there is just an underlying assumption that there are mechanisms for the institution of Beis Din. And what I like to do when I speak is to point out how in different parashios we just read, there actually are references to the Beis Din process. So in Parshas Tetzaveh, for example, and we'll be reading it again in the coming weeks, there is the description of the Big Day Kahuna. And one of the Big Day Kahuna, one of the clothes that were worn by the Kohanim, by the Kohen Gadol, was the Choshen HaMishpat, was the actual breastplate that the Kohen Gadol wore, that according to the Gemara in Zevachim actually atoned for mistakes that might be made in a jurisprudence, in the Bate Din. That was actually the function of the Choshen HaMishpat, and the section in the Shulchan Aruch that deals with laws of civil jurisprudence, which are supposed to be overseen by the Beis Din, by the rabbinical courts in every single community and throughout all the generations, is actually called Choshen Mishpat, named after this garment of the Kohen Gadol, which is the garment that represents the Jewish judicial system. And Rashi and Parshas Tetzaveh actually notes that Mishpat, that the word of Mishpat of justice, which is epitomized or embodied by the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, reflects three different parts of the judicial process. One part of the judicial process is the Tanos Habali Dinim, are the claims of the litigants when the litigants actually appear before Beis Din. It is the methodology by which claims are raised and are presented before a court. The second, says Rashi, is Ugamar HaDin. It is the decision-making process of the Beis Din. It is the decision-making process of what the judgment is going to be. And the third is Ve'onish HaDin. And the third is the actual judgment, the actual carrying out of the judgment of the Beis Din, the execution of the verdict of the Beis Din. Once a decision has been meted out, then that decision has to be carried out. That's what we call the Onish HaDin, the execution of the judgment. And the Beis Din essentially serves the community in terms of all three steps of this process, being the place to go when there is a dispute between parties that needs to be registered and adjudicated somewhere, in terms of articulating and formulating the rules by which a dispute is going to be resolved and is going to be decided. And then finally, in terms of developing a framework by which the judgments and the decisions of the Beis Din can actually be carried out. Of course, the first question that arises is, okay, so then under what circumstances does a case, does a dispute actually have to go through the initial stage of being presented to a Beis Din? When is there a requirement of a person to go to a Beis Din? So the most startling thing that I will tell you, and this also relates to some degree to the Parshas HaShavua that we just read, is that there is no requirement for a person to go to Beis Din. Meaning a person can go through their entire life without going to Beis Din. And they will not have committed an Aveira per se. That there is many people in this room, I suspect, have never actually gone to Beis Din, and you need not worry, because the halacha does not say that when you must have a dispute with people, and then you must, when you have a dispute with a person, go to Beis Din. It is perfectly acceptable and even considered to be laudable never to have a dispute with anybody. That you always live your life with such shalom, with such peace and harmony, that you never come to have a dispute. And in the event that you do have a dispute, it is perfectly acceptable to just sit down with the other person and resolve the matter between two people. One of the questions that I actually did receive from time to time when I served as the director of the Beis Din of America in New York City was when a person would call me up and say, I have a dispute with another person in my community, and we would like to just be able to sit down with each other or maybe find somebody from the community who has a good judgment and good mediation skills, and we'd like to just be able to figure out a way to resolve our dispute without going to Beis Din. Is that okay? So the answer is, that's okay. It's more than okay. It's considered to be a mitzvah. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, at the beginning of Sanhedrin, talks about the great virtue of Aaron HaKohen. It says that Aaron HaKohen was so great that he would prevent disputes from having to go to Beis Din altogether. That whenever he saw that two people had a sichsuch, had some sort of a quarrel between them, he would be an oev shalom, verodev shalom. He would be a lover and pursuer of peace, as it says about Aaron HaKohen in Pirkei Avos. And he would go to one party and say that the other person feels bad, and he would go to the second person and say the first person feels bad, and maybe they didn't really feel so bad about each other, but deep down Aaron HaKohen knew that they wanted to do the right thing. And by the time he finished speaking to the two parties, he was able to make shalom. He was able to enable everyone else to see the other side a little bit. They would compromise a little bit, and he was the master of effecting a settlement between parties so that the dispute would not have to go to Beis Din altogether. So there is no actual requirement to ever go to Beis Din. It is perfectly acceptable to never get into fights, and if you do get into a fight, to just resolve it by yourselves without having to go to Beis Din. Rather, what then is the obligation? The obligation is twofold. One, that we are told we must have a Beis Din. That is the pasuk in Parsha Shoftim. The first pasuk says, "Shoftim mishotrim titen lecha b'chol she'arecha," that you should establish a court system. You should have judges, and you should have police officers to enforce the judgments of Beis Din, and you should have this in all of your gates. You should have this in all of your communities. You must have a Beis Din set up. And this is because, in the event that there is a need for a Beis Din, and there are various matters that require Beis Din even besides disputes, so you need a Beis Din to do a get, you need a Beis Din to do a chalitza, you need a Beis Din to do a conversion, but even for purposes of disputes, in the event that there is a dispute, this way there will be a Beis Din available. I would submit, in terms of this past week's parsha, that maybe this was a little bit of what was going on after the Chet HaEgel. This is an original thought, so you can assertively disagree with it. At the end of Parshas Mishpatim, we're told that when Moshe Rabbeinu was about to go up the mountain to spend time learning Torah directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before, after which he would bring down the Luchos, so Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Hivinei Aaron v'chori machem." He said that I'm going to go up, but the rest of the Jewish people will have Aaron with them. They'll have Hur, the nephew of Aaron, with them. Mi ba'al dvarim yigash aleihem. And anybody who has a matter, they can approach Aaron v'Hur. And the Gemara in Baba Kama actually says that this is the source for the principle of Hamotzi mechaveru alav haraya. That if a person has wants to exact something from somebody else, they feel that somebody else owes them money, then they're the ones who have to prove that the other party owes them money. You can't just go and grab the money. You have to bring a proof. But what is that? What is the Gemara really saying? What the Gemara is really saying is that you have to go through a judicial process in order to be able to prove your case before a judicial court. And the analogy that the Gemara gives basically is that just like you have to have a hospital to treat a sick person, there's no mitzvah to go to a hospital. It's perfectly okay never to get sick and never to have to go to a hospital, but the community has to set up a hospital to be able to cure people. So too, you have to have a judicial mechanism by which people can assert their claims. It says the kaivle kaiva, if somebody has a pain, azil beasya. So the person goes to the doctor, the person goes to a hospital. So too, by the same token, if a person has a dispute, so you have to have mibal dvarim yigash aleihem, you have to have some sort of judicial mechanism. But what was the problem of what happened after the Chet HaEgel? The problem of what happened is that Aaron HaKohen tried to use his usual methodology of, at the time of the Chet HaEgel, of being able to resolve what he saw as a state of unrest within the community, and he tried to use his skills of pshara, his skills of being able to effect a settlement without a full judicial process. So what? Thank you very much. So says the Gemara that even though normally speaking we say mitzvah lipsoa, normally speaking it's a mitzvah to enable parties to reach a settlement without a judicial process altogether, nonetheless sometimes we say botzei berech nietz Hashem. sometimes if you bring about a settlement in a way which is antithetical to Torah values, thank you, then the result is not in accordance with the wishes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A settlement also has to be in accordance with the Torah values. The Gemara elsewhere criticizes a certain type of bezdin, that a certain type of a judge of a Jewish court that is referred to as Dayanei Chatzatzta, as judges of Chatzatzta. What are Dayanei Chatzatzta? Dayanei Chatzatzta are Dayanim who believe that the role of a Jewish court is that whenever you have two parties who present a dispute, so you always basically effect an automatic compromise of splitting everything 50-50. So somebody comes and he says, Reuven says, Shimon owes me $10,000. Reuven made it up out of thin air. Shimon doesn't owe him anything. And the Bezdin says, oh, okay, Shimon says he owes nothing. Reuven says $10,000, so we'll split it in half and make it $5,000. So that's what the Gemara calls Dayanei Chatzatzta. That's called effecting some type of a compromise or settlement that is based on absolutely nothing, that is completely contrary to principles of justice. So that's called just splitting the baby in half. Some say, look, Shlomo HaMelech was the greatest judicial figure. And look how he's resolved one of the most difficult disputes that was brought before him. He had two women who came. One said, the baby is mine. One said, the baby is mine. So what did Shlomo HaMelech say? He said, split the baby in half. So therefore, they say we should always split the baby in half. The trouble is that if you look at the case very carefully, you'll see that Shlomo HaMelech actually, in reality, did not split the baby in half. He used that as a ploy to be able to reach the correct verdict of determining who should get the baby in its entirety, and it would not have been a very satisfactory result. In fact, had he split the baby in half. So too the Gemara says that it's not appropriate to be Dayanei Chatzatzta. So the Gemara says that in this particular case of the Chet HaEgel, Aaron HaKohen actually, according to one version in the Gemara, Tanchum Baruch HaNilai, says that Aaron HaKohen messed up in this case. Aaron HaKohen thought, okay, I'll make, there's a dispute in the community, there's a whole bunch of people, there's unrest, they want to build build an egel. So he said, I'll make, according to the way Rashi puts it, he made a pshara beino lebein atzmo. He figured out some sort of pshara in his capacity as being the go-to guy based on Moshe Rabbeinu's stipulation. And he said, look, they're going to kill me if I don't let them build the egel. So better I should let them build the egel, and then afterwards they can always do tshuva. So that type of a calculation where the people are going to engage in a very grave sin was not considered to be an appropriate calculation from the standpoint of Jewish justice. So therefore, even when it comes to a pre-Bezdin stage of being able to work out an appropriate non-judicial resolution that will be able to maintain the harmony among the people, there are certain rules that apply. Just like Yehuda is criticized in the Gemara for saying, Mabetza kinavogis esachino, said that it's not, he said it's not considered to be a good pshara to kill Yosef, so instead let's sell him. So that's also not considered to be a perfect pshara, because selling him also wasn't such a good idea. So you have to determine what's considered to be within the realm of justice when you come up with what the Gemara calls bitsua, with even a settlement proposition. But since really there is no obligation to go to Bezdin per se, if a dispute can be resolved otherwise, so what then is the obligation? So it's essentially a negative obligation, that in the event that somebody is going to go to a court of law, so then one has to go to a Bezdin and not to a secular court. This is the pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim that says, Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher, these are the laws that shall be placed in front of them, and the Gemara derives in front of them, meaning that whenever there are civil disputes, then the civil disputes have to be presented in front of Jewish judges that are described in Parshas Mishpatim, have been described in Parshas Yisrael before Parshas Mishpatim, and velo lifnei arkos, and not in front of Akum, not in front of the secular courts, not in front of the non-Jewish courts. And Rashi al-Hachumish explains that because this is because you are giving honor to the secular authorities. You're giving honor to their religions, and you are desecrating, essentially, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because you are implying that the justice system that we have set up through our own court system is insufficient or inadequate to be able to resolve our disputes. So therefore, that is why there is an actual iser. There is a prohibition described in the Torah from going to secular courts, and this prohibition exists up until this day, that there is a prohibition when one is handling a dispute. They may not go in front of a secular court, but if it can be resolved just between the parties amicably, can be resolved through a mediator who helps the parties come to a fine resolution, or even if it can be resolved in a way in which it is otherwise not brought in front of the secular courts, then there's no prohibition. Rabbi Akiva Eger, in his comments at the beginning of the Choshen Mishpat, the Shulchan Aruch, the portion of Shulchan Aruch devoted to these laws. So Rabbi Akiva Eger, in Siman Gimel, talks about the following case. What if you have an industry where within that industry, say it's the diamond industry or the architect's industry, there is a custom that whenever there are disputes regarding a particular transaction, instead of the dispute being brought to court, the dispute is brought in front of an arbitration tribunal of experts within that industry. Like if in the diamond industry, it would be brought in front of three diamond dealers. Or in your standard contract of architects, so the American Architects Association, it usually says in the contract, if there's a dispute between the architect and the owner of the house who hired the architect, then it shall be brought in front of the standard arbitration board of architects. So Rabbi Akiva Eger says, and in such a case, there's absolutely no prohibition of submitting the disputes in front of this board. But you're not going to Beis Din. He says, that's not there's no prohibition. If you can resolve the dispute without going to Beis Din, it's fine. The problem would be if you're going to a secular court. But this is not a secular court. They're not operating under the court system. They're not subject to the court system. They're not obligated to follow principles of secular law or secular statutes. There's no notion of giving honor to a separate religion or giving honor to a separate system. This is just a bunch of people who happen to be expert in that particular industry, and they use their secular, yeah, sure, they use whatever happens to be the norms and standards and practices and principles of that industry to settle the dispute between these parties. So therefore, since there is no violation of our calls, there's no obligation for the parties to go to Beis Din in such a case. It's only when the parties actually need to go through some type of court process where there's going to be a court system involved, so then there's a prohibition from going to the secular court system, and one is then obligated to go to a Beis Din. But then there's a separate question that arises. What then is the jurisdiction of Beis Din? Let's say the parties have to go to court. So does that encompass every single dispute under the sun? Are there every single type of quarrel, every single type of controversy that arises has to go in front of a Beis Din? Is there anything which is excluded from this rule? So the general principle is that a Beis Din has jurisdiction when it comes to monetary matters, meaning the dealings, mishpatim, dealings between different parties, contract disputes, real estate disputes, a dispute in a loan transaction, a dispute regarding a Yerusha, an inheritance, any type of dispute regarding an investment, a dispute regarding a broker fee, all of these types of disputes would be within the province of Beis Din, presumably. However, the Gemara in Baba Kama, around Daf Bei Dalet, talks about how when the Torah speaks about the jurisdiction of Beis Din, it's speaking about a very specific type of individual. It's speaking about smuchin, because it uses the word Elokim. That's the Elokim, is a word that refers to a Kaddish Baruch Hu, but it also sometimes refers to Dayanim. Elokim Yisarba Das Kel, Bekeru Kelu Elokim Yishpot. Sometimes it's a reference to how Dayanim are essentially serving a very important function, that they are representing the Shechina. They're represented to be a Dayan is to represent the Shechina and to represent the divine justice system of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore that's why it's a very solemn task. However, this type of individual who has this status is an individual who receives smicha directly from Moshe Rabbeinu, who received from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. However, the chain of smicha directly from Moshe Rabbeinu, we're told, ran out at a certain point in time, so we don't have smuchin anymore. So therefore, how is it that Dayanim who don't have smicha are able to adjudicate cases if they don't have the real original smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu? So the Gemara says, well, the Dayanim in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, didn't have smicha, but they relied on shtukasayot kavdinon. They relied on being essentially geographical agents of those dayanim, those judges in Eretz Yisrael who had smicha. So Tosfos asked the question: what about dayanim nowadays? Dayanim nowadays, though, they're both neither in Eretz Yisrael nor in Chutz La'aretz. Nobody has smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu anymore. It's a different type of smicha that we have nowadays. So Tosfos says that we extend that it's just like we can extend this principle of agency geographically. We can also extend it temporally, and we can say shlichus sayo de kamayka avdinan, that the dayanim today are essentially agents of the original dayanim from years and years ago, from over 1,000 years ago, the last line of dayanim who had their smicha as a direct line, directly traced to Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore they have jurisdiction. But then the Gemara says, but with this jurisdiction that was given as a result of the principle of shlichus sayo of agency, did not extend to all matters. It only extended to matters which are dvarim, things, matters which are milsa de ispe chisar and kis, something which results in monetary loss, and dava hashchiach, and it has to be something which commonly occurs. So the Gemara carves out certain types of cases which are not so common. A person knocking off the limb of another person is not considered to be terribly common. And there are other types of charges which don't involve chisar and kis. Like, for example, somebody embarrasses somebody else. They haven't lost money per se, but they've been embarrassed. That's considered to be a knas. It's considered to be more in the realm of a penalty. So there's a whole realm of a jurisdiction of different types of disputes that, according to the Gemara, don't seem to fall within the province of Beis Din, because they're not milsa de ispe chisar and kis. Milsa the ispe chisaron kis ushchiach, that they don't seem to have both of these elements of being common and involving the loss of money. So do you say that any type of dispute that doesn't fall into those categories can then be brought to secular court because they're not automatically within the purview of Beis Din? So in fact, I had this claim raised once when I was at, I remember that in one case that we dealt with in the Beis Din, somebody had driven a bicycle. Somebody's son had been driving a bicycle in a camp, and that was owned by somebody else. I don't think it was anything was insured, apparently. But the bike apparently hit a pothole, and the kid fell off the bike, and he injured himself, and he broke a leg, something like that. And the family of this child wanted to sue the camp owner, and the camp owner, as a defense from having to go to Beis Din, said, I don't think that this is within Beis Din jurisdiction, because there are shitas and achronim, and some machlokas between the Shach and the Shvus Yaakov about whether a nezik, whether a tort liability that results from a boar, that results from, say, a pit that's lying in the middle of the street, that somebody falls into a pit. So there's a dispute as to whether this is included within Shlichus Ayah, whether this is considered to be a common enough type of case that this is subject to the continuing jurisdiction of Beis Din. So he said, since there are authorities that say that this type of a nezek, this type of a liability is not included, therefore we don't have to go to Beis Din, and we would rather... And if you wanted, they didn't think that the plaintiff would have enough money to afford to take them to civil court, so he said, try to take us to civil court. They didn't think that that would end up happening. So that was the question, that Beis Din did not have jurisdiction just because it didn't fall into Milsa de Shchiach V'yesh Bach Yisar and Kis. So the Beis Yosef in Siman Chav Vav and Shulchan Aruch and Kol Shem Mishpat says that's not what it means. It doesn't mean that if you have a monetary dispute that doesn't neatly fall into the category of something which is common and has monetary loss, that any other type of dispute is outside of the province of Beis Din. It just means that in those types of cases, Beis Din is limited in terms of its ability to administer justice in accordance with the strict letter of the law as it it's recorded in the initial sources in the Talmud. However, the case still has to be brought before Beis Din. There still is a violation of going to secular court. It's just that once it comes before the Beis Din then will decide the case according to principles of equity as opposed to strict law. And the Beis Din, if it feels appropriate, can always assign the case to secular court and have the secular court be its agent. But the case first has to be brought in front of Beis Din, and then Beis Din makes that calculation. So therefore, this type of an argument is completely faulty. There's no such thing as any type of monetary dispute that doesn't have to first be brought into Beis Din. Now, Beis Din determines the scope of its jurisdiction and what types of awards it can give out or it can't give out, but the case must, in all circumstances, be brought in front of Beis Din. However, this is all within the realm of monetary jurisdiction. If you're dealing with, instead of civil jurisdiction, you're dealing with criminal jurisdiction, so criminal jurisdiction is a different story altogether. If you have a case which where a person has committed a crime, somebody has murdered somebody else, so Beis Din doesn't have jurisdiction over murder. When the Sanhedrin was moved out of Lishkas Hagozis, out of the chamber in the Beis HaMikdash, it no longer had capital jurisdiction. And in any event, criminal jurisdiction is a function of the government where somebody lives. It's not a dispute between Reuven and Shimon. If Reuven killed Shimon, so Shimon's not the one who's bringing Reuven to court, so Shimon can't. The party bringing Reuven to court is the government. So these are cases which are dependent upon the government. It's not a dispute between two Jews. It's a mandate of the government to keep law and order. So therefore, a government, no matter where you live, has jurisdiction with respect to criminal cases. There are separate issues of whether one is allowed to serve as a district attorney and to hand over criminals to the government. Is it a just government? Is this considered to be Mesira? That's a whole separate area of dispute. But Beis Din doesn't have jurisdiction. We don't have jails. We don't have the ability to mete out the punishment with respect to criminal matters. So criminal matters that are outside of the civil context, that's the job of the government to handle criminal matters. So therefore, the Beis Din's main jurisdiction is when it comes to the disputes between parties that would normally be subject to civil jurisdiction. So we say if Reuven is taking Shimon to court, as opposed to the government is taking Shimon to court, but Reuven is taking Shimon to court. So Reuven has to go to a Beis Din court as opposed to a civil court, and that is the initiation of the process. So that is in terms of the first step of where do you go in order to raise the dispute to begin with. So we say, Mibal Dorim Yigash Aleihem, a person, the Karvlek Iva, Asya the Bay Asya, person who has a pain, a person who has a problem, so they have to go to the courts, and you have to go to a Jewish court, you have to go to Beis Din. But now the matter is in front of Beis Din, so what if the two parties, both say, what if Shimon says, I would rather go to secular court? So Reuven says, I want to go to Beis Din, and Shimon says, I'd rather go to secular court. So the halacha is that Shimon is still obligated to go to Beis Din. So Reuven is taking him to Beis Din. What if Reuven turns around and says to Shimon, okay, you want to go to secular court? You know what? I'm just as happy in secular court as well. I don't have to go to Beis Din. I'm perfectly happy to go to secular court. Reuven and Shimon both agree between themselves they're going to go to secular court. Can they make a bargain that the halacha says we're supposed to go to Beis Din, but we're both in agreement we'll go to secular court? Are you allowed to do that? So the general principle is that when it comes to monetary matters, parties are allowed to make conditions. The Mishnah in Baba Metzia and Daf Tzadi Dalim and Aleph says, for example, that if you have somebody who is a shomer sacher, the person would be obligated normally in Geneva Va'abeda, they are watching somebody's property and they're getting paid for it, and if the property gets stolen, they would be responsible to pay for the loss. But if they're a shomer chinam, if they're not getting paid for watching the property, they wouldn't be responsible for if the property got stolen. So they say, despite the fact I'm being paid, we're going to make a deal. He makes a deal with the person entrusting the property to him that I'm not going to be responsible if it gets stolen from me. So are they allowed to do that? It's against what the Torah says. So the Mishnah says they're allowed to do that. We essentially paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. We hold like the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda that call Tanai Shiba Mamon Kayim. Whenever I have monetary rules that are set by the Torah between two people, if the two people want to stipulate on their own that they'll have a different set of rules, so they're allowed to stipulate to a different set of rules. So are they then allowed to stipulate that, okay, so the Torah says we're supposed to go to a Beis Din, but we're stipulating that we're going to go to civil court. So the Ramban al-Chumash at the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim says they're not allowed to do this. says normally parties can make this type of a stipulation when it comes to monetary matters, but the halacha, the Jewish law rule, that there is an obligation not to go to secular court is not just a monetary rule. This is a ritual rule, meaning this is considered to be a ritual prohibition. And just like parties are not allowed to contract around ritual prohibitions, they can't contract around this one either. Parties aren't allowed to say to each other, okay, we're going to make a contract, and part of our deal in the contract is that we're going to work on Shabbos. They're not allowed to do that because you can't make a condition against the ritual prohibition. Or they're going to say, we're going to make a contract that we're going to eat treif. So you can't do that. So too, you're not allowed to make a contract that you're going to go to secular court. So that's what the Ramban says, and that's basically how we paskin halacha lemaisa. You can't make such a condition. But what if, nonetheless, Shimon says, I don't care what the halacha is. I'm going to commit an avera over here. I am not going to go to Beis Din. I don't trust Beis Din. I don't accept the notion that Beis Din has relevance in my life. And therefore, I insist that I refuse to show up in front of a Beis Din. So the truth is, Shimon has the right to say, I want to go to a different Beis Din. If there's a Beis Din kavua in the city, there's one Beis Din that the entire city, all of Philadelphia, has accepted upon itself a particular Beis Din. So then Shimon doesn't have the right to say, I want to go to a different Beis Din. He has to go to the local Beis Din. But if there is no set Beis Din, Moshe Feinstein writes that when it comes to New York City, in New York City there are many different Batei Dins. There's no one set Beis Din. Everyone has accepted upon themselves. So Reuven wants to take Shimon to Beis Din A in New York City. Shimon can say, I want to go to Beis Din B in New York City. So what happens if they can't agree upon a Beis Din? So do we say, okay, they can't agree upon a Beis Din, now they'll go to secular court? No, they can't agree upon a Beis Din. So then the halacha is, this is brought down in the Bar HaGola on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, that then they have to both sit down together and they have to find the Beis Din that's mutually acceptable to both of them. Maybe the two Batei Din that they chose can work out a mutually agreeable Beis Din. And if they can't figure out a mutually agreeable Beis Din, so then then it becomes converted into a Zabla proceeding. What's a Zabla proceeding? Zabla is an acronym. The acronym of Zabla stands for Zeh Borer Lo Echad. This one chooses one Dayan, Zeh. This one, Borer, chooses Lo for himself, Echad, one Dayan. And the other party chooses for himself another Dayan. Each one chooses a Dayan. And those two Dayanim pick a third Dayan. And between those three Dayanim, then they have what's called an ad hoc Beis Din. And that ad hoc Beis Din decides the case. There's a common misconception that people think that once it becomes a Zabla, so all bets are off from normal Beis Din procedure. Normal Beis Din procedure, the Dayanim are supposed to be just and objective. And they're not supposed to have ex parte conversations with the parties, and they're not supposed to take money from the parties, and they're supposed to be completely honest and upfront and completely neutral. So some people think, so when you have a Zabla, so that means that one person picks an advocate who's definitely going to vote for him, and the other person picks an advocate who's definitely going to vote for him or her. And as much as they want to have sidebar conversations with the person they pick, they can have sidebar conversations and so forth and so forth. And the only one who's kind of kept out of all of these different dealings is the third Dayan, who's picked by the first two Dayanim. So the Rosh already said in his commentary to the Gemara in Perek Zeh Borer in Masechet Sanhedrin, that's not the case at all. That's not what a Zabla is supposed to be. A Zabla is supposed to be basically where each party is comfortable with the process because they pick the Dayan they're comfortable with, but that Dayan is supposed to be completely neutral and objective, and there's still supposed to be a possibility that Dayan can vote against the party who selected him. So therefore, the next step would be a Zabla procedure, but it's very important that the Zabla procedure be done properly. However, it's only in the, what if you have a case where Shimon refuses to submit to the Beis Din that Reuven wanted, refuses to pick a different Beis Din, and refuses to submit to a Zabla proceeding either. He says, I'm not going to go to anything. I'm not going to go to your Beis Din. I'm not going to go to another Beis Din. I'm not going to submit to a Zabla. I'm just going to have nothing to do with the Beis Din procedure. So the Gemara in Baba Kama has a very cryptic statement. The Gemara in Baba Kama in Daf Tzadi Beis Amud Beis has the following description. It says, Amalei Rava L'Rabba Bamari. Rabbi said to Rabbi Bamari, the Gemara there had a recitation of a number of different types of circumstances where there is a popular folk saying. And the Gemara points out that whenever there's a popular folk saying and that has some truth to it, there is a concomitant corresponding phrase in the Torah. So every chokhmah that's out there, you can find in the Torah. So the Gemara says, how do we know the truth of this folk saying that people say if you call your friend and he doesn't answer? You send him emails, you leave voice messages, everything, doesn't text him, doesn't answer. Rami Guda Rabba Shadibe. So how do you know that in such a case you could take a big wall and you could throw it on top of him? The whole thing is difficult to understand. Okay. So Amalei, yeah, we have a pasuk in Yechezkel. It says, Yan Teotikav lo tihartami tumasech, that I've tried to purify you and you haven't purified yourself, lo titari od, so all bets are off, you'll never become purified. So what's the Gemara talking about? What's the whole thing? What's the case over here? The whole thing seems extremely mysterious and cryptic. So the Rosh, in his commentary to Maseches Baba Kama, on this Gemara, on Sadi Beis, Amar Beis, and Baba Kama, said that the Gemara is talking about somebody, Reuven, who's summoning Shimon to come to a Din Torah. You're calling Shimon. What are you calling? You're not calling Shimon for a Shabbos lunch invitation. You're calling Shimon. Then you wouldn't be able to throw a wall at him. You're calling Shimon to come to Bezdin. And Shimon refuses to come to Bezdin, says, there's no way I'm coming to Bezdin. So then, Mikan Pasuk Rapaltaizal, Rapaltai, the Gaon, ruled based on this Gemara, the Reuven Yesheshel Tfi al Shimon, Mesar Lavoi Moladin. Reuven has a claim upon Shimon, and Shimon refuses to come to a Din Torah, Shavashela Avila Kol Shanochim. In such a case, then you offer Mesar, then Reuven is allowed to go to secular court, Kedei Lotia Shlomi Takas Yodo, in order to be able to recover his claim, in order to be able to assert his claim and recover damages. Then in such a case, that Shimon refuses to go to Beis Din, so then there is a halacha that the Gemara records, then in such a case, then there is a provision permitting Reuven to actually take the case to secular courts. But Sam Sofer and others explain that it's not here that we're relaxing the general prohibition, it's just that here the Beis Din is basically making a determination that they will assert their jurisdiction through the agency of the secular court, that they are referring the case to the secular court as a court of secondary jurisdiction. The Beis Din is still the court of primary jurisdiction. Reuven had to turn to the Beis Din first. It's only when the Beis Din determines that Shimon is not going to show up, so then the Beis Din essentially rules that Reuven has the right to pursue his claim in secular court. So that in this case, basically the secular court serves as an arm of the Beis Din. And then there's a further dispute about whether Reuven would be allowed to recover damages in secular court that he would not otherwise have been able to recover in Beis Din. And some say, based on this Gemara, that since it's essentially a penalty, you pick up a heavy wall and you throw it on the other party, so we see that going to secular court is essentially a punishment for Shimon for refusing to go to Beis Din, and for a punishment you can impose more damages than he might otherwise have been liable. So some say, based on this Gemara, even though others argue that this is a source, this seems to be the minhag olam, that if in such an event Reuven recovers even more in the secular court than he would have recovered in Beis Din, he doesn't have to return that excess amount. So that is the most obvious case, or the paradigmatic case, in which we would permit, as a matter of halacha, for Reuven to take Shimon to Beis Din as opposed to secular court. I'm sorry, we would permit Reuven to take Shimon to secular court as opposed to Beis Din, because Shimon refused to go to Beis Din. Some of the Mephorshim ask the following question. They ask, what if Reuven knows up front that Shimon would never go to Beis Din? Like, for example, if a Reuven wants to bring a party who's not Jewish to court, so the Tashbetz says that even then, the appropriate forum is Beis Din if the non-Jewish party would be willing to go to Beis Din. However, do you have to send a summons to the non-Jewish party to come to Beis Din? No, because the assumption is that a non-Jewish party has no interest in going to a Beis Din, that they are more comfortable going to their usual court system and going to a court. It happens that at the Beis Din of America, we had a couple of cases where a non-Jewish party brought a Jewish party to Beis Din, where the non-Jewish party was the plaintiff, and they felt that they would do better at being able to enforce a judgment against the Jewish party if it was part of the Beis Din system. And therefore, they brought the case to Beis Din. I sat in a case involving a major banker, a case worth millions of dollars, where the bank brought a Jewish party to the Beis Din. So then, of course, the Beis Din hears the case. But if the Jewish party wants to bring a non-Jewish party to court, so they don't have to work with the assumption that the non-Jewish party would ever want to come to Beis Din, of course, they could then send them a summons from a regular court. So the question is, what if you have a Jewish party? But your assumption is, this is a Jewish party who's so far out of the parsha of coming to Beis Din that there's no way this person would ever agree to come to Beis Din. So there are some who said, this is found in the Kesef HaKadshim, some were of the opinion that in such a case, you don't even have to bother going through a hazmana process of sending a summons from a Beis Din to the party to come to Beis Din, because you know that they would never go to Beis Din, so you can go directly to secular court. However, the common practice is not that. That way. The common practice is that, especially in an age whereas all the lawyers in the crowd can attest, ADR, alternative dispute resolution, has become much more popular, you can no longer work with the assumption that a person will automatically reject the notion of coming to Beis Din. And especially a Jewish party who has a mitzvah of coming to Beis Din as opposed to secular court, it's appropriate to give them a chance first, send them a hazmana, send them a summons, and see what their response is, because maybe they will agree to go to Beis Din, and only in the event that they refuse to go to Beis Din would it be permissible to take them to secular court afterwards. So that's the assumed to be the halakha. When you're dealing with a Jewish party, there would never be a basis for not taking them to Beis Din. But what if the party is Jewish but they're not Jewish? What do you mean? What do I mean they're Jewish but they're not Jewish? Let's take the case that I gave you before, where a person gets harmed in somebody's bungalow colony or a camp or something like that, but the party that the plaintiff wants to sue is covered by insurance, and the insurance company is not Jewish. So then in such a case, do you still have to go to Beis Din, or do you say, no, I can work with the assumption that the insurance company is not going to want to go to Beis Din. The insurance coverage is intended for a judgment that would be handed out by a regular secular court. And therefore, in this case, I will just summon the other party to a regular court, because the real party in interest over here is the insurance company. It's not the named party in the lawsuit, but the damages are really going to come from the insurance company. So Rabbi J. David Bleich, actually, in an article that he wrote on the subject, says that he thinks that there, since there's essentially a contract that basically stipulates that if there are damages, they will be covered by the insurance company, that the plaintiff has the right to go after the insurance company and to sue directly in court, even though the named party on the suit might be the Jewish party, because the real party in interest is the insurance company, and one could work with the assumption that the insurance company won't come to Beis Din. So some people have told me that nowadays maybe this isn't such an obvious assumption. It could be that maybe insurance companies would be more comfortable nowadays going to Beis Din, because they're so sick of the court system and some of the large judgments that are awarded there. Maybe they figure no matter what kind of judgment the Beis Din would give, it's not going to be as bad as what's in court. So that's a question mark. But if you can assume that the expectation is that they wouldn't want to go to Beis Din, so then there are some poskim who say that in such a case could be pursued in civil court, because the real party in interest is not the Jewish party, but rather is the insurance company. Arguably, the insurance company is serving as some kind of an arif, some type of a guarantor of an obligation over here, and one is allowed to go after, as long as they're in Arab Kablan, then a person is allowed to go after a guarantor to collect their debt, so the person can just as easily go after the guarantor as they can go after the original party, and that could be a justification for going to secular court, at least in insurance cases. This is a debated issue. Not everybody holds this way. There's a law of tshuva by one of the Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael that was published a few years ago about this issue, distinguishing between different types of insurance. It might depend upon whether it's an insurance that everybody carries, and that where there's a deemed understanding that you're going after the insurance company or not. It plays out in a more complicated fashion in the other direction, where the defendant says, I don't want to go to Beis Din, but I'd rather go to secular court because I'm covered by insurance. So in such a case, the plaintiff could say, look, I have a right to go after the guarantor, but I can also go after the original party. Unless we say that there was an understanding between the parties that you're only going to go after the guarantor, you're only going to go after the insurance company. It's like an Arev Shluftut, as the Gemara says. So then that's a question as to whether there was such a deal, there was such a meeting of the minds, that there was an understanding up front, that if there would ever be, if it's the type of dispute, like a car accident, the type of where everybody knows that it's the insurance company that ultimately pays. But there are certain types of insurance, like employee liability insurance. That nowadays, people take out insurance policies if there would ever be a termination claim made by an employee. So can you say that the employee was on notice that the employer had such an insurance policy that if they ever were going to file for severance pay or for lost wages upon termination, that they agreed they would only go to secular court after the insurance company and not to Beis Din? So that's not so clear. Sometimes the defendant's company might say, or the defendant's employer might say, I don't want to go to Beis Din because maybe they'll give Chodesh Lashana a month for every year, and in secular court I'll do much better. So then it really is dependent upon whether there was a real contractual understanding between the parties that they would only go after the insurance company and not anybody else. But then let's assume that you're already in Beis Din for the second part of the deliberation, which is the actual judgment. So is it ever appropriate that the Beis Din will incorporate secular law in their deliberation? We said that two parties are not allowed to agree that they're going to go to that they're going to go to secular court as opposed to Beis Din, because that's not considered to be a Tanai Shem Mamon. That's not considered to be a condition with respect to monetary matters. That's considered to be a condition with respect to ritual prohibitions. But what if the parties both say, okay, we'll go to Beis Din, but our normal course of dealings and our contractual relations are consistent with secular law. So therefore, we're going to go to Beis Din, but we're going to tell Beis Din that we want the Beis Din to follow the secular law. So in such a case, do we say that's also a violation of our cause? That's also something you can't make a condition about, or are you allowed to make a condition about that type of a thing? So the Sma on the Shulchan Aruch, one of the commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, says very explicitly, very clearly, that that type of a condition would be perfectly acceptable. It seems to be the clear shita of the Sma. That's not considered to be a violation of a ritual prohibition. You're saying that we want our contract, just like the Shomechinam, the person who's getting paid to watch bailment, says, I want to be treated like a Shomechinam. So too, parties could say, we want our transactions to be dealt with consistent with a certain arrangement that is more consistent with secular law. So the Sma seems to say it's okay. Some say that the Taz disagrees with the Sma. If you look at the Taz, it doesn't seem so obvious to me that the Taz disagrees with the Sma either. But the big question is how to read a certain Rashba. This is the last source that I have on the page. There's a Rashba that was talking about a case where there was an inheritance dispute, where there was a woman who died after being married to her husband for about a year. And the secular practice was that in such a circumstance, the inheritance or the assets of the wife, instead of going to the husband, would go to the wife's father. There were no children. So the law was, in such a case, the inheritance would go to the wife's possessions would go to the wife's father. And halacha is, Jewish law is, that the husband inherits his wife. The question was, do we assume that everybody from a certain community intended to follow, to be bound by secular law, and therefore secular law would be binding upon the parties as opposed to halacha, and the inheritance would go back to the father? So the Rashba has a very difficult to understand tshuva, in which the Rashba basically starts off by saying, yes, of course, it's perfectly okay to have such a condition, and there's a Gemara Yerushalmi that says that people used to make conditions like this all the time, and you can make whatever conditions you want when it comes to monetary matters. But then the Rashba continues and says, however, to do this in order to imitate the Goyim, to do this in order to imitate what the secular law says, so that would be absolutely prohibited, and if everybody did that, we wouldn't have laws of inheritance anymore according to the Torah, and the Torah would have to wear ashes and sackcloth, and there would be nothing left of all of the Sfarim that we have in the Beis Medrash. There would be no purpose to them, and this would be a hideous thing. So the question is, how do you walk away from that Rashba? What do you take away from it? So some that take away from that Rashba, that they say, look, you see from the Rashba, he says you're not allowed to make conditions that follow secular law. And others say, no, that's not what the Rashba said. What the Rashba said that is that if there was no condition made, so then you can't work with the assumption that an entire community would just throw away the Torah and only follow secular law. But if you have an individual transaction between two parties, where the parties say we want our transaction to follow secular law, then the Rashba seems to say that that's perfectly okay. And some have a compromise sheet and say, no, well, normally you could contract to do something something which is against Torah law, it's because you can make any kind of condition when it comes to monetary matters, but you can't make a condition that is specifically making reference to the secular legal system. You could say, yeah, normally I'd be liable, but we're going to stipulate I won't be liable. Normally I would be liable, I wouldn't be liable, but we're going to stipulate I would be liable. But to say we're going to follow the secular system, so that's a problem of loli fnei akum. So this is a dispute between different authorities. In fact, there was one major Dayan figure in Eretz Yisrael, I think Rav Zvia Spitz, who wrote an essay on this subject about two Israelis who wanted to contract that the real estate contract would be governed by the Israeli real estate statute. But he considers that to be secular law. This is already a famous tshuva of the Chazanish, also in the materials, that in Eretz Yisrael, if the entire country is going, you're going to have a law in the books that everyone has to follow the secular law of their base mishpat system, and not the Bezdin system. So that's also a violation. You can't do that. But that's probably more along the lines of what the Rashba was talking about. But what if in an individual contract, two parties said that we want the real estate law of the secular law to govern our transactions? So he says, well, you can't reference the secular law. Let's say that it's statute section 335 in the official statute book. So you can't say our transaction will be governed by section 335 of the statutes. But what you can do is make a photocopy of section 335 and say it's a 20-page section and say we want our contract to be governed by the following rules. And take out the lettering section 335 and just reprint the next 30 pages. And that would be perfectly okay because that's a Tanai Shimon moment. You're not explicitly referencing the secular law. So if Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, another major dynamic, he doesn't really understand the distinction. He thinks if one is permitted, then the other would be permitted as well, that there's no reason why two parties in an individual case wouldn't be able to make this type of a contract. So that's generally the position that was taken and has been taken by the Bezdin of America in accordance with the view of Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, that if you have two parties in an individual case who say, based on really their own minhag, this is the minhag, the custom where we are, is that these are the practices that are followed, and we want our case to follow these practices. So then the Bezdin would enforce that, even if it was consistent with secular law. But Moshe Feinstein goes even further and says that if you have a case where the expectation is, they're like landlord-tenant disputes, where the expectation is that the parties intended to be governed by secular laws anyway, because that's the way, that's what's usually followed in the industry. Then even if they didn't explicitly contract that the secular law will be governing, that's the law that would be applied by the Bezdin. So finally, I'll just conclude with the 2 minutes. The last part of what we discussed was the actual enforcement of the law. So the Medrash Tanchuma says on the pasuk Shoftim Meshotrim Titzen Lecha, you should have judges and you should have police officers. He says, "Im ein shoter ein shofet." If you don't have a police officer, so you don't have a judge. In order for a judicial system to be effective, you have to have police officers. So with the Gemara, the Mishnah in Gittin on Peches Amar Beis says sometimes a Bezdin can utilize the secular court system to be their police officers. If a Bezdin decrees that a man has to give his wife a get, and then the man isn't complying, so then the Mishnah says that if the secular court basically whips the guy and says, "Asay mashi solomim lacha," do what the Bezdin tells you to do, so that's considered to be a perfectly valid get. It's not considered to be like it was coerced by Gentiles. It was coerced by the Bezdin. It's just that the secular court is carrying out the Bezdin's decree. So too, in a secular government, where it's the secular governmental officials that have to carry out the Bezdin's decree, so then the Bezdin basically is allowed to, and even is supposed to, utilize the secular courts to enforce their decisions. And if the secular court statute says that a Bezdin's decision will only be carried out if the parties sign an arbitration agreement, so then the Bezdin has to have the party sign an arbitration agreement. And then if a party says, "I'll go in front of Bezdin and I won't sign an arbitration agreement," then they're in violation of their obligation to come before Bezdin, because then they're not allowing the decision to be enforceable. They have to submit to Bezdin in such a way that the decision will be enforceable. They have to sign the arbitration agreement. And then when the Bezdin issues its decision, the decision will be as enforceable, will be carried out as if it was a secular court decision. You can have the sheriff's marshal, the losing party's assets if they don't end up paying. However, you shouldn't have to come to that, because the Gemara says, what is the right attitude that a person is supposed to have when they come out of Bezdin? It says that a person who is lezom in Bezdin, the person who leaves Bezdin, a shock of glima, and the Bezdin took the shirt off their backs because they ruled that they were guilty, they were culpable, and they had to lose the shirt off their backs. So the Gemara says that Zomer Zmirta, that the person should sing a song, Velezel Beorcha, and dance along. The person should just be whistling Dixie. He should be very, very happy that the Bez then lifted the shirt off their backs, because this way they were cleansed of any theft that they had in their hands. A person is supposed to be grateful at a Bezdin verdict, even if they were losing the party, because this way the Bezdin essentially made them whole. It made them shalem, because if they had too much, so therefore they gave it away. So this way they've been perfectly addressed in terms of what they need in life. And that is supposed to be the attitude. But if for some strange reason a person doesn't have that attitude, so then the Bezdin and the party who's the losing party doesn't want to pay, so then the Bezdin is allowed, the other party is allowed to utilize the secular courts in order to be able to enforce the jurisdiction of the Bezdin. That's the way the most Bate Din set up their judgments, that they empower, that's the way our Bezdin, the Bezdin of America, empowers the parties to be able to enforce the judgments in court, so that it can be carried out properly afterwards. But the attitude that everybody should have is in accordance with what the Pasuk in Zechariah says, Emes u'mishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'areichem. The purpose of having our judicial system is to bring about peace and harmony. And the Gemara in Baba Metzia, I'll end with this, says that L'chava Yerushalayim al shadanu din Torah, that Yerushalayim was only destroyed because they decided according to din Torah. So the Gemara says, wait, there's a typo here. It should be the Yerushalayim was destroyed because they didn't follow din Torah. So the Gemara says, no. The problem was that L'chava Yerushalayim el ha'amidu d'vayam din Torah. The reason Yerushalayim was destroyed was because everybody insisted on getting every single last penny that was due to them. Below also l'fnim mishiras ha'din. And they didn't go above it and beyond the letter of the law. Not only the mediator, the Aaron HaKohens, are supposed to figure out how to go above and beyond the letter of the law. The parties themselves are supposed to figure out how to compromise and reach a settlement in a just and proper way that goes above and beyond the letter of the law. The people are supposed to give up a little bit sometimes on what they feel is due to them in order to achieve peace and harmony. So that's Hashem. We should all be successful at being able to promote our Bezdin system, to be able to make a Kiddush Hashem and use the Bezdin system as appropriate, and to be able to promote peace and harmony in the world in full fulfillment of Emes u'mishpat shalom shiftu b'sha'areichem. Thank you very much. Okay, I will now take questions for a few minutes. Thank you.
It's hard to believe that somebody who's either non-Jewish or a secular Jew could possibly get the same quality of justice in front of a Beis Din. I mean, wouldn't there be some inherent discrimination against someone who doesn't respect either Judaism or the Halakha? I mean, how could a ruling Beis Din look at people equally?
So Bezdin is supposed to, okay,
the other's not.
Let me answer. The Bezdin is supposed to treat everybody the same. This is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, and you have to go to a Bezdin that follows the halacha. The halacha, the Gemara says, it says, tzedek tzedek tirdof, that righteousness, righteousness pursue it. So it seems like it's a very nice expression, but the Gemara says it's redundant. That's the obvious question. You should have just said tzedek tirdof. Why did I say tzedek tzedek tirdof? So the Gemara answers, it means you not only have to go to Bezdin, you have to find the proper Bezdin. Holeichacha Bezdin Yofeh. You have to find the Bezdin that follows all the rules. So you have to do your research and go to a Bezdin that follows all the rules. And if you're afraid that you can't find the Bezdin that follows all the rules, so then it's your obligation to establish a Bezdin that follows all the rules. Or to improve the Bate Din that are in your area, to make sure that they are as perfect as possible, and that they treat everybody equally and the same. Yeah.
Let's say you go to Bezdin
So, so the halacha is that you have to go to Beis Din for all areas where Beis Din is able to enforce proper judgment. Generally speaking, even when it comes to matters of American law, to the extent that they're binding upon members of the Jewish community. So why are they binding? Halacha, the Torah just gave us, the Torah gave us Kol Shemishpat. Why then would we have an obligation to follow any of these other laws? So there's a principle of Dina de Machus Adina, that the law of the land is a binding law even upon the Jewish population. So if there is an American law, an ordinance that's supposed to be followed, and it has been promulgated for the purpose of regulating proper economic commerce throughout the entire country so that the government would care that everybody follows the law uniformly, like bankruptcy law. You can't have some people who opt out of bankruptcy law. Bankruptcy law, in order to be effective and to promote its economic goals, has to be followed by everybody. You can't just say that, okay, so bankruptcy law says there's an automatic stay, and now this debtor doesn't have to pay off any of its creditors, and the creditors all have to join together as one class, and they're going to have to follow the reorganization plan or the liquidation plan, and everybody's only going to get a few cents in the dollar, but since the debtor is Jewish and there's a Jewish creditor, so this Jewish creditor is going to make a sidebar deal saying, you'll give me a preference, you'll pay up my debt, and everybody else will just get a few cents in the dollar. So the government would say, we don't allow that. We don't allow that because that disturbs and destroys the whole uniformity of bankruptcy laws. So you can't do that. There's a tshuva by Rav Moshe, which Rav Moshe seems to think suggests that maybe you could do that. But Rav Moshe, I don't think was working with the assumption or with the I don't know if the bankruptcy laws have been fully explained, because in the same tshuva, Rav Moshe says you got to follow bankruptcy law, you know, which says that you can't collect first. You only collect your unsecured, and you only get to collect after the secured creditors, and you come afterwards, and you have to follow because it's dina d'malchus. Then he says at the end, yeah, but you know, if you want to work out that, you know, he'll pay you, like, you know, you see somebody's about to become bankrupt, and you know, you can collect in full beforehand, so you know, then go ahead. So that that would be a preference under bankruptcy law. So Pistama Rav Moshe would agree that if such a thing would be included within bankruptcy laws, that you can't do that either. So if you have, you know, an American law which falls under the scope of Dina d'Malchus HaDina, it's something which the government doesn't allow you to contract around. It doesn't say, yeah, we have a default law, but if you're Jewish and you want to follow Jewish law, then that's okay with us. But rather, they have what we call a strong public policy consideration, that they want everybody to follow this particular monetary law. So that would be binding upon the Jewish community as well, and that would become incorporated into the halacha as part of Dina d'Malchus HaDina. Yes?
In some parts of the country, there's been a sentiment against Islamic law in the last year or two. Has there been any parallel development against Jewish law?
Not that I know of, and the truth of the matter is that I'm not in agreement with the sentiment, meaning that I think that we have a very good set of checks and controls within the American arbitration law system, which says that we're going to focus, we're going to give parties freedom to agree between themselves if they want a separate arbitration body, whether it's the American Arbitration Association or a Bezin or a Sharia court, to decide a case according to their principles. We're going to give freedom because we want to give freedom to parties to settle their disputes as they see fit. We're just meticulous that certain procedural rules be followed, that everybody get the chance to present their case fairly, that everybody be allowed to be represented by counsel, that there shouldn't be ex parte communications, there shouldn't be fraud or corruption in the deliberation. But otherwise, as long as the procedural rules of arbitration law and arbitration statutes are followed, and there shouldn't be any reason why parties shouldn't be allowed to contract that the substantive law applied to the case would be in accordance with halakhic principles. Whenever there is a public policy, what I would call dina d'malchus HaDina, requirement on the part of a secular law that even the religious court follow, you know, certain public policy principles like bankruptcy law, so then that would be incorporated within the halacha. But otherwise, I don't think that there's a reason to discriminate against any religious court system. Yes, Rabbi Gross.
We had the case of the bike before, that the person that there is disagreeing about whether they go to basement or not. So two questions. The one, what if this person, the person says, very nice, Rabbi Reese, you think I should be going to basement? I have a posting that says I don't have to go to basement. That's A. And the second one is, what if he can't find a posting? He just says, my understanding of the law is different than yours as head of basement of America. So what power does basement have at that point? And he hasn't signed an arbitration agreement, he hasn't been involved in anything.
Bezdin at that point only has ecclesiastical power. If a party refuses to submit to the jurisdiction of a Bezdin, so then the Bezdin does not have arbitration power to enforce any judgment. But the truth of the matter is, Bezdin is not going to issue a judgment in that case because it doesn't have the ability to bring both parties in front of it. What Bezdin has the ability to do is to issue an ecclesiastical statement that this party, in our opinion, is in violation of Jewish law for refusing to come in front of a Bezdin. And that's a determination that a Bezdin has the right to declare on its own. And if a party doesn't listen to the Beis Din has the right to issue a contempt order. The contempt order is not an enforceable document from a secular law perspective, but from a community perspective, it carries with it moral and religious weight. That to the extent that the person lives in a community that cares about the fact that the Beis Din that it trusts and respects issued a contempt order, so then it presumably will have repercussions upon that person.
But is there if a person says, is there a Kimley case, and like a person says, I hold like a different opinion than this Beis Din, does he have a right to say that?
So that's for the Beis Din to determine, meaning ultimately that's a Beis Din determination. A Beis Din is not bound to follow. A person finds a posek. Very often a person can find a posek. The person finds a posek who supports their view. The Beis Din is not obligated to follow that posek. The Beis Din has to follow its own internal rules. Now there's a separate principle, which is Beis Din basa Beis Din lo daiki. If one Beis Din issues a decision in a case because the parties came before that Beis Din, submitted to that Beis Din, so generally speaking, another Beis Din, even if they may have decided differently, is not going to challenge the decision of the first Beis Din. That's a different consideration of Beis Din basa Beis Din lo daiki.
Would that lead to a seir of law in this case? The person says, I disagree with that.
If a Beis Din determines that the person is wrong, or the Beis Din considers the arguments where the person says, I'm not subject to Beis Din jurisdiction, the Beis Din says, you are subject to our jurisdiction, or you are subject to the jurisdiction of a Beis Din, so then the party wants, they can say, look, I don't trust you as a Beis Din, but I think this other Beis Din will see things more my way, and I want to go to that other Beis Din. Fine, and then they could do that. And then the first Beis Din won't issue a seir. But if they're not going to subject themselves to the jurisdiction of a single Beis Din, and instead they say, no, I'm just picking a rabbi whom I trust, and I'm relying on that rabbi, that's not good enough. You have to be able to find the Beis Din that's going to be able to support you. If you can't find a single Beis Din that supports you, so that means there's something very questionable about your claim.
That comes to go to our codes.
Yeah. Yes?
What's the role or obligation, or I guess in some ways maybe limitations, on an attorney whose client comes to him and says, I have potential claims against a party and I want to bring it to secular court. So in other words, I can't go ahead and contract around saying I'm going to go to Beis Din. What about the attorney? In other words, my client comes and says, okay, I want to take him to court.
So an attorney is in a difficult position. This is one of the challenges of being an attorney and being a firm attorney. Let's say you have a client who wants to violate this halacha and take another Jewish party to a secular court. So you have to say, no, you should take him to Beis Din. You're not supposed to assist in a commission of an avera. That's called lifnei iver lo sitein mekshel. So you say, if he wouldn't go to you, he'd go to another attorney. So then already it's knocked down a level. Then we say that's not a deraisa violation, it's only a derabbanan violation. And some say, okay, well maybe if he's such an avraya and he's such a terrible sinner that this is an area where he's incorrigible. So then some say that if he's a mumar, even for one avera, so then you can knock down the derabbanan violation. But why work so hard to knock down the violation? Just tell him to go to Beis Din. We had cases in where judges basically turn to parties. This happens in New York all the time. They turn to two parties, like especially two observant parties in front of the judge, and the judge looks at them and says, what are you doing in front of me? Go in front of a Beis Din.
Wow.
Yeah.
The fact that we have so many laws, criminal law, bankruptcy law, and so many that actually go in front of the secular courts, how is it that now in our time it's Hilul Hashem to bring other cases also in front of the secular court? Which is just that monetary portion of...
Well, what other cases are you talking about?
Hilul Hashem apply in the case?
And what type of... Tell me what case you're talking about.
Yeah, all the criminal laws. Anything that's criminal, you have to make it the secular.
Beis Din is not going to adjudicate a murder case. It's a chil Hashem if we don't turn over murders to the government. It's the opposite. You have to make sure that it's a halacha v'yata rami kebecha. You have criminals in your midst. So that's a halacha that the Rambam brings down in Hilchos Mesira and Hilchos. I think Kovel Mazik, the Rambam has a number of halachas about turning in offenders to the secular government. So he says you have somebody who's a Meitzer Harabim, somebody who's causing undue distress to an entire community through the criminal actions that they're performing. So then you're supposed to turn them to the government. Yeah.
I'm interested in following up what Shlomo asked you, which is you have the practice, a client comes to you and says, I have a case, I'm bringing it in civil court. You tell him, and I've had this situation, and he says, no way, there's no way I'm going in front of these rabbis. Do you think that the attorney has an obligation not to represent him when you know I thought you might say that.
But an attorney has to do their part. I think the person could probably, you know, I don't know that it's a good idea to encourage this type of behavior. I'm saying if you want to work out the details of a heter, you could probably work out the details of a heter on some level in some of these cases. But I don't know that from a community policy perspective that it's a good idea. Ultimately, if there's an awareness from attorneys are directing parties when they're supposed to go to Besdin to go to Besdin, I think that that creates a better, you know, appreciation of how serious an obligation this is.
But do you think the attorney has to withdraw? In other words, if the person
so I think if there's an individual case, you could discuss the details of an individual case. The way to come to a heter is a complicated route, and it would depend on a lot of different circumstances and relying upon a lot of different shitos isn't necessarily encouraged to rely upon.
Okay. What's the corporation though? Typically is the case. The parties, even in a real estate dispute, it's Shimon is really 481 Main Street LLC.
So a corporation is an interesting story, but the poskim talk about what's the status of a corporation. Does halacha recognize the status of a corporation altogether? So generally speaking, halacha says a corporation is really a partnership of all of the different parties who are involved in that corporation. So if it's primarily owned by Jews, or even if it's managed or controlled by Jews, so then we view it as essentially a Jewish party, because it's the Jewish party or the Jewish parties who run the organization, and then one is supposed to take them to Bezin as opposed to secular court. That's separate and distinct from the question of whether contracts made with a corporation are subject to the laws that we would attribute to corporations. You could still say that insofar as you make a contract with a corporation, there's an understanding of what that entails and what the liabilities of the corporation are, insofar as it would have limited liability and you would have, you know, non-recourse basically against the principles of the company. So then we could say that you bound yourself by that understanding in dealing with a corporation, and the Besdin, if it would hear the case, would most probably decide the case according to those principles. But nonetheless, there still would be an obligation to bring the corporation to a Besdin if the corporation was essentially a Jewish corporation. Yes?
Your distinction between criminal and tort doesn't always make such a sharp line. I mean, even in the case of murder, the estate would have a tort claim if it chose to bring one. It probably wouldn't, and I can, obviously it's cognizable as a criminal action, but lots of things that are, almost everything that's cognizable as a criminal claim is also, one could, if one chose to, make it a tort. So to what extent does that
whatever can be separated as a separate civil case that one would be able to normally bring in civil court could also be brought to Besdin, as long as you could sever the criminal adjudication from the civil adjudication. But if it would necessarily involve criminal adjudication, then the Besdin wouldn't be able to engage in that. Yes?
How do you handle a situation where one leaves this country owing debts, whether it's to individuals or to institutions, and makes aliyah?
It's a good thing we encourage aliyah. It's a mitzvah.
What do you do?
I mean, one party is here in America and the other party is in Eretz Yisrael. So what do we do in such a case? The Shulchan Aruch says that generally speaking, if the plaintiff is in one location, the defendant is in a second location, we say holchin achara nitpa. You go after the defendant. You go after the defendant's location. But the post can point out, it's a wonderful sefer on these types of procedural issues called Seder Adin, by Rav Elia of Shochetman. So Rav Shochetman devotes a chapter to this, and he says that's applicable if when the dispute began, the one party lived in New York and the other party lived in Israel. But if the entire nexus of the dispute was New York, and then only after the dispute was completed, the one party ran off to Israel, so then it would stand to reason that the plaintiff would have the right to insist that the defendant come back to New York in order to adjudicate the dispute over there. Then we wouldn't say Hokin Achara Nitpa. However, in any event where you have parties in different locations, it does not absolve either party from a Din Torah. It just means that you have to figure out what the appropriate venue is, where the Din Torah will end up taking place. Okay, does anyone didn't ask? Well, yes.
I'd like to ask a question in two parts about the general issue of agunot, because this is a situation apart from the fact of its urgency in many communities, I think it's in regarding law, it's one of the rare situations, it seems to me, that affects the future rather than the past. Because a woman who is an aguna cannot remarry, cannot produce children for the Jewish community, and I think it is very far-reaching and distinct from crimes that affect the past, where, you know, either it's a done deal, unfortunately, say in the case of murder, or somebody's losing money from the past. So here are my two quick questions. And I know it's a very complicated issue.
You have to give me time to answer, because at some point I'm going to have to, okay.
So number one, with regard to the issue of prenuptials. So here there is a, a legal device or a legal tool that has been developed in the secular world. But it seems very much to be, at least to me, and I'm a lay person, very much in tune with the goals of the ketubah. So it's just sort of like the next step. What do we need in contemporary times to protect the woman? The ketubah, whenever it came into being, I'm not sure, did that for them. And now things are more complicated. So is there a way that there would be a rabbinic power to say, to adopt/adapt this tool from the secular world into the halakhic world? Because I know, for example, that there are many rabbis who will not marry a couple without a prenup. The second thing is that that you mentioned a lot of, that if you're not happy with the way one is based in adjudicates, then you can go to the other. But it seems from the little that I know that there is an enormous amount of politics involved in the Aguna question, so that that a lot of faith deans are not prepared to overrule or supersede or even intervene where another faith dean claims that it has jurisdiction. Mm. So how do you overcome the politics here? Because the idea of going from one faith dean to another, whatever those problems are in the first place, don't apply here because nobody wants to touch a case that another jurisdiction says is mine.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll try to answer the question sufficiently. With respect to the first question, you made reference to the prenuptial agreement. There is a form of arbitration agreement / prenuptial agreement that actually was promulgated by the Beis Din of America, which was drafted in consultation with both halakhic experts as well as attorneys. So this is actually a case of a document that satisfies halakhic standards, but is also enforceable in secular court. It basically says that whenever there is a dispute between husband and wife, that they agree up front when they get married that they will submit any dispute to a particular Beis Din, and particularly with respect to the issue of a get, where secular courts don't have jurisdiction with respect to the issue of the get, nor should they, but the parties can't automatically be brought into the Beis Din unless they sign an arbitration agreement, and this way they signed it up front before they get into the more messy fighting afterwards, God forbid, in which case it will be much more difficult to agree upon a particular Beis Din, and that way the Beis Din does have jurisdiction to issue a decision, even to issue a monetary judgment, and through their jurisdiction and through their ability to issue a monetary judgment, we have found that generally, really, in 100% of the cases where that has occurred, the get has been given and the issues have been appropriately resolved. With respect to the second question, oh, that's a different story. This is one of the reasons. Look, you know, you go into a car, and you put on a seatbelt. It doesn't necessarily guarantee safety, but the vast majority of the time, you're going to be much better off with a seatbelt than without a seatbelt. So everyone's going to be better off signing a prenuptial agreement, in my humble opinion. So it's something which is strongly recommended. You can't enforce a prenuptial agreement if the parties did not actually sign the prenuptial agreement. Can Rabbanim adopt a policy that they're only going to officiate at weddings if the parties enter into a prenuptial agreement? I happen to think it's a good policy. It's my own personal policy. But with respect to the second question, what I enunciated earlier was actually the principle of Bezdin Basa Bezdin Lodaiki, meaning that there is a general protocol among Batei Din that once a case is within the jurisdiction of one Bezdin, another Bezdin does not trample upon that jurisdiction or take over where the parties had already submitted their dispute to a particular Bezdin. The general practice that has developed in America, with respect to this matter, because you don't have a hierarchical Bezdin system where there's one Bezdin that's the main, the Bezdin Agadol, and then another Bezdin that's underneath, and then a Bezdin that's underneath that. Every Bezdin is its own entity. So if every single Bezdin would constantly interfere with other Batei Din and question their judgments and try to take over their jurisdiction, you would have absolute chaos. So that doesn't happen. But what sometimes occurs is if parties are particularly unhappy with a particular Bezdin, then instead of the Bezdin submitting to a different Bezdin, sometimes there's an agreement, they'll go to, say, an Adam Gadol. They'll go to a very chashuv Rav, whom everybody respects, and that Rav will try to review the situation and speak to the Bezdin, and then they'll be able to see if something could be done maybe a little bit differently from how it was done. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Okay, maybe we'll okay. This will be the last question, and then I'm happy to take phone calls. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that if there's one accepted Beit Din in the entire city, so that would be the Beit Din that people are expected to go to. And I'm wondering if you have, let's say, a community which is partly Ashkenazic and partly Sephardic, and kind of everybody, maybe 200 years ago was in their country and had all their accepted customs, and now that we've all come together and we've sort of in some ways formed one community, in some ways we haven't. Mm-hmm. So if you have an Ashkenazic party and a Sephardic party, you are coming to a Beit Din, is that something you would take into account, where you might choose to follow a different posse because of who the parties are? And by the same token, if you have, let's say, two Ashkenazic parties, but one of them is pushing for you to accept, let's say, a Sephardic opinion which had never been accepted in the Ashkenazic world until now, in either case, how would you handle that?
So the halakhic guidelines as to when you're allowed to follow different opinions, when somebody who's Ashkenazi can follow the opinion of the Mechaber, who represents the Sephardic tradition, and so forth. So a Bezdin has to look at the parties that are in front of them. They have to look at what the expectation of dealings was between the parties when they entered into an arrangement, because Tanai plays a part in this. Did they intend to follow this opinion? Did they intend to follow that opinion? And a Bezdin has to treat these cases with thoughtfulness and intelligence. Okay, good. We'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Rabbi Reese is on a tight schedule, so if you want to contact him, please do so by phone. But okay.
In fact, if anybody has no time, we're going to quickly have him zoom in. Shlomo's going to leave.
Am I doing El Nino or no?
Rabbi
John, I'm in the library. Yeah. Find you on Yosef or find you on Yosef stuff.
He's... Thank you.
Really? But maybe I'm wrong.
I'll think again. Thank you for whatever.
Oh, yeah, wait a minute.
You sure?
Absolutely.
All right.
Don't thank me.
Thank Alice too.
There's some extra.